Okay, this is Bio 241, and it is February 28th, and we're just going over the schedule a little bit. Don't forget, on March 5th, which is next Tuesday, after this weekend coming up immediately, is exam number one. And exam number one is going to cover chapters 1, 2, 3, and 6. 1, 2, 3, and 6. And to prepare for that lecture exam, just use the exam study guide, right? Because when I make up an exam, I go to the exam study guide to figure out what kind of questions I want to put on the exam. So that's where it's coming from. But of course, you have to read the textbook and everything else that's listed in the study guide for you to do. And there's a chem flash quiz, so you can practice identifying various chemicals in that flash quiz. And let's see what else is there. I think that's pretty much about it. Any questions for the exam coming up? Okay, lots of questions. All right, what's the number of the chapter that we were talking about? Three? Okay. All right, so I don't even know if I'm going to show you any of these slides. I think I just want to draw some important things out on the board. Okay. We're almost ready. Okay, so you got to know something about all these organelles. You got to be able to identify them by their structure. And once you understand their structure, you have to tell me at least one important thing that they're doing inside the cell. All right, so for mitochondria, what is that doing? Is it using up oxygen? Is it producing CO2? Is it gobbling up glucose? All those things it is doing, but that's not the important thing. The important thing is what? Making ATP. So it's using all those things, but to make ATP, that's the important thing. Protein synthesis, how many steps in protein synthesis are there? Two. And you got to know their names? What's the first step? Transcription. Second step is translation. So information goes from DNA to what's the next molecule? RNA, and that process you just told me was transcription. Does it ever go backwards?
No.
Okay. Yeah, it never goes backwards, but we know some examples now where that's not necessarily true, but for this class, you can just say no. What's the second process called? Translation. And where does that take place? In the cytoplasm. What kind of organelles are necessary for that? That are absolutely necessary? The ribosome. Yeah. Endoplasmic reticulum is not, but if a protein is going to end up inside of a vesicle or outside the cell, then endoplasmic reticulum, is, in particular rough ER, is necessary. All right, so that's kind of a little bit of a review. All right, so for the test also, don't forget your chemistry. Look over that periodic table one more time. Make sure you know what atomic number is, how to find it. The abbreviations for those important elements that we find in biological systems, like name one. Oxygen is good, carbon, hydrogen, sure, those are all important ones. So make sure you know all their symbols. And Fe, you should know, which is what?
Iron.
Yeah, so some of those are a little tricky. All right, so let's start talking about the cell cycle. By first, I think I had this diagram on the board. All right, so here we have a cell with a nucleus. What's inside the nucleus? Yeah, genetic material. And as a matter of fact, for us, it's going to be arranged in chromosomes. And should there be an even number or an odd number of chromosomes in there? I'm not sure people would really appreciate that, but you should answer that when we're done with lecture. There should always be an even number of chromosomes if it is a healthy cell. And in people, it's 46. Okay, and I think we said that at one time we were all just this single cell, and this single cell is what we call a zygote. Okay, and we also agreed that that's a really kind of lousy stage of life because you can't come to physiology lecture and take notes, right? So in order to get big, okay, the cell has to divide, and it's going to divide into these two cells. Can anybody remember what we call these two cells? Daughter cells. Right, so these are daughter, and so here's a daughter, and this one over here we said is a zygote, but for this process it has another name. It's a parent cell. Same thing. All right, and this process, before I tell you the name of the process, how many chromosomes are in here and here? 46. All right, so the cell is not just splitting apart, right? Because if it's split apart from the parent cell, then each cell would have 23 chromosomes, right? But something has to happen. During this phase of the cell cycle, a chromosome, which looks like this, gets replicated, and you should know something about replication. How could you describe replication to somebody, just a bullet point, just a couple words? It is what? Semi-conservative. Replication is semi-conservative. All right, so after replication, we have actually one chromosome, but two copies of it joined together after DNA replication. That happens when the cell is what we call an interphase. All right, so we got both 46, 46 over here. And what's the difference between the daughter cell and the parent cell? Absolutely nothing, right? Because I didn't change color of the pens. We got black and black, 46 chromosomes everywhere. Okay, so this process right here is what we call mitosis. And you should know the reasons why we undergo mitosis. We already talked about one, but we didn't write it down, so let's write it down. Why is there such a thing as mitosis? Because at one time you were here, and today you are what? You're here.
Growth.
Yeah, growth is really important, right? So one function of mitosis is growth. So just don't say reproduction, because mitosis really means reproduction, a certain kind of reproduction. So growth is one reason. What's another reason?
Repair.
Yeah, repair. Old and damaged cells. Or replace. So we could say replace or repair. Okay, as a matter of fact, I don't know if I like repair. Replace old or damaged cells. It's actually a replacement, old or damaged cells. And I always use an example of blood, because we all know that a red blood cell does not have a nucleus. It's kind of funny. And as a result, it can't repair itself. It just dies. So red blood cells don't live for a very long period of time. They only live for about 120 days. And then they die. And you don't want all these dead red blood cells in your body, so they're recycled, they're broken down, and the components are reused to make new red blood cells. Does anybody know about how many red blood cells die in your body every second? 127. Close, but let's multiply that by like 900,000. Okay, so about 1 to 2 million red blood cells die in your body every second. So what's that condition called when you run low on red blood cells? What is that called?
Anemia.
So what does your body have to do to prevent you from becoming anemic? If you're losing about 2 million red blood cells every second, what does your body have to do? Yeah, it has to replace them, right? Via mitosis. It has to build about 2 million red blood cells every second, which is, I don't know, I think you guys are really busy all the time. Even though maybe you're studying or not studying, sleeping, your body is really busy doing that kind of thing. So to replace old and damaged cells is another reason for mitosis. Because cells in our body all the time break down and leave us, and they have to be replaced. All right, so we're going to look at some things about mitosis. This phase right here is not an active form of mitosis, but this is a stage that the cell has to get into before mitosis can take place. And this is what we call interphase. Interphase is a part of the cell cycle where the cell is growing and replicating DNA and reproducing or replicating organelles. Okay, so here is the whole cell cycle, and I pretty much like this diagram. I think maybe I would simplify it a little bit. But what is the longest phase of the cell cycle? What's the longest phase of the cell cycle? I think to scale, this is, it's not too bad. It is. Which phase takes up most of the of this circle right here? You can see interphase. Yeah, so interphase is where most cells can be found in. Okay, and during interphase, we just said that it's a growth phase. So G1, we have organelles that replicate, and replicate just means what? It means duplicating themselves, making another copy. Then we have DNA replication during the S phase, which follows G1. And then G2 is the final growth phase before mitosis can take place. And there are actually a lot of checks that the cell undergoes to make sure that DNA has been replicated, that organelles have been replicated, because once mitosis starts, it can't go back and make some of these things if it's missing. So the cell just takes inventory if it is really ready to divide during G2 over here. Okay, so then the first phase of active mitosis, right, we see is prophase. The next phase is metaphase, and we see a little bit of an illustration of what it looks like on this slide. All right, and there's basically four phases. So mitosis is the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells. All right, so I want you to kind of think of it that way. Mitosis is the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells. And I see something else on this diagram, cytokinesis. Right, for this class, I would like for you to know that cytokinesis takes place within telophase. Some textbooks say, well, sometimes it starts in anaphase and all different kinds of places. Well, it depends on conditions that the cell is in and what kind of cell it is, all kinds of different things. Right, but I want you to say that cytokinesis is a subphase of telophase, and telophase is the last phase of mitosis. And a good definition for cytosis is the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. So think of cytokinesis and mitosis as being two kind of separate things. They work together and they're intertwined, but mitosis is the separation of genetic material. Cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. So that's a really good way, I think, to think of it. All right, so here I see a chromosome. And what can you tell me about this chromosome? Has it been replicated? Yeah, because I see, okay, I see two chromatids right here. All right, so each one of these things, sometimes we call this a daughter chromatid. And so there are two copies of that one chromosome, but nonetheless, we still call it a chromosome. Okay, so here is one chromatid, here's another one. They join together at the centromere, and that centromere is going to be an important feature because this is where it attaches to the spindle apparatus, which is going to move these different parts of a chromosome around inside the cell. All right, so make sure you know the four phases and the correct order of mitosis, which you do already, and maybe you have written down an acronym that will tell you the correct order of these phases of mitosis. What's that acronym? You can just have what? Some people say they can remember very easily IPMAT. That's just an acronym for all the first letters in these words. Right? So interphase, prophase, metaphase, M, A for anaphase, T for telophase. And we're leaving out cytokinesis here. That's just the way it goes. All right, so that might stick in your mind because there's a team of specially educated people that can run around and clean up the freeways or the harbor if there's a chemical spill someplace or this building if there's a chemical spill. They can clean up that mess without getting hurt themselves. What's that crew called? It's called the hazardous materials crew, or commonly we just call it hazmat. All right, so have you ever heard of hazmat before? I hope so, because then it's going to be easy to remember this thing right here, all right, IPMAT. So you should know some features of each of these phases. All right, so what was the feature of interphase that we looked at? DNA replication, growth phase, and then there's a phase where the cell checks to see if it can actually complete mitosis successfully. Does it have all the necessary things going for it? All right, that's G2. Okay, prophase. This is where chromosomes become visible and distinct structures inside the nucleus. So the nucleus is sort of still there at the beginning of prophase. And during interphase, let's go back to this slide over here. Okay, I see just strands and strands and strands of chromatin on this chromosome. And you can see that when it's on a chromosome, it's all wound up on proteins that we call histones, right? And when it's all wound up on these histones, then it can't be used by the cell to get at the genes to make new proteins. So when a chromosome, when DNA is in this kind of configuration, which we call condensed chromatin, here's a little bit of an extended region of extended chromatin, here's condensed. When it's DNA is in a condensed form like this, it's a very safe form. And when it's in an extended form, it's in a very fragile form. It can be damaged. All right, so during interphase, the DNA is in an extended form, It can be used to make new proteins, but it can be damaged, which is the reason why it's behind the nuclear envelope. It's protected by the nuclear membrane. We looked at the nuclear membrane already. Okay, but when mitosis begins, the nuclear membrane is going to disappear, so the chromatin has to be in a protected form. Right, so here is condensed chromatin, and when all these long strands of DNA condense into condensed chromatin, then it's big enough to even see underneath the light microscope. Okay, that's why we say this is visible. Okay, so prophase is the first phase. Chromosomes become visible because chromatin condenses. So that might be a good key feature for you to write down. Condensation of chromatin. Or the appearance of chromosomes. That's sort of the same thing, but if you say condensation of chromatin, I think that means a little bit more. All right, something else that happens during prophase is that the nuclear membrane disappears. That's something else that happens. I'm going to mention some other things a little bit later on, but let's get through these phases. Metaphase, the chromosomes, which are replicated like this, have been attached to microtubules inside the system, and these microtubules push and pull them, so all the chromosomes line up exactly on the equator of the cell, right smack in the middle of the cell. And this is the shortest phase of mitosis. It might only last for a couple seconds. So you're kind of lucky if you see it on a microscope slide. Okay, and it's position. All these chromosomes are positioned with those microtubules, which we call spindle fibers of the spindle apparatus. In anaphase, then, these daughter chromatids separate, and then we call them sister chromatids as they start to separate, and they end up on either ends of the cell. All right, so anaphase is when the chromosomes begin to separate. All right, then, the last phase, telophase, at this point in time, the sister chromatids are pulled all the way to opposite ends of the cell, up against the centrioles or centrosomes that control the spindle apparatus, and then the cells actually start to pinch apart through that process of cytokinesis. All right, so telophase, a good example, something good to say about telophase is cytokinesis happens during it, okay, and that's a whole mouthful right there, and then the nuclear membrane starts to reappear to protect that genetic material, because after telophase, then that condensed chromatin is going to be pulled off of a chromosome, it's going to be extended, and it can be easily damaged, but it has to be protected behind the nuclear membrane before that happens. So here are some slides. During interphase, all of this chromatin basically is in an extended form. It's being used to make proteins. And so these molecules are just too long and too thin to see underneath a microscope, actually way too thin. All right, but when this chromatin condenses, then all of a sudden you can begin to see some structure inside the nucleus. So this is the beginning of chromosomes where the nucleus is. I can't see the nuclear envelope. Maybe I can see it here. I don't see it on this slide. So maybe that's another thing that you should remember. The nuclear envelope disappears during prophase. Here's metaphase, easily seen. It's probably the most easily identified stage. So you can see that the centromeres of these chromosomes have attached to the spindle apparatus, or these fibers of the spindle apparatus, they're microtubules, and they push and pull these chromosomes so that they line up exactly on the equator of the cell. And then the last phase, oh no, this is not the last phase, the next phase is anaphase, where the daughter chromatids turn into sister chromatids because they're being separated apart. So this thing turns into something that looks like this. All right, so each end of the cell gets an exact copy of the DNA that the parent cell has. And then here is telophase, the last phase. One thing I said is that the nuclear membrane starts to reappear. I don't see it on this slide. I don't see that on this illustration right here. But that's probably a good thing for you to know. And then the cells start to separate by making this cleavage furrow. So there's this big dimple that forms as a ring around the parent cell. And that ring gets what? Smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And then finally, then these two cells are completely pinched apart. And, of course, the DNA is already in opposite ends of the cell. And when the cell pinches apart, the cytoplasm also gets separated into two daughter cells. So what do we call that when the cytoplasm gets separated during telophase by this development of the cleavage furrow and the pinching apart of two cells? That is cytokinesis. All right, and then mitosis is complete. Okay, the centrosomes, these are what we said coordinate and build the microtubule system inside the cell. And what was one way that we characterized the microtubule system? It's a monorail. Yeah, so things can attach to it, or things can be attached to it by other mechanisms inside the cell, and microtubules then can move these things around inside the cell, whether they're vesicles or organelles or chromosomes, for instance. Okay. Telomeres. Well, maybe I'll say something interesting about telomeres. What does what phase of mitosis is telophase? Is it the beginning, the middle, or the end? It's the end. And that's what telo means. It means the end of something, right? So in terms of mitosis, telophase is just a functional way of thinking about this word telo. But it could also refer to a structure. Like here is a telomere. A telomere is the tip of a chromosome. So it's the very end of a chromosome. Here are telomeres. Right here, right here, right here, right here. Okay, and they don't code for proteins. Okay, but each time a cell divides, a length of that telomere is lost because DNA polymerase can't work on it because that segment is too short. So every time the cell undergoes mitosis, then we get less and less and less of a telomere. And when that happens, when the telomere is all used up, then the cell can't undergo mitosis and then it's going to die as a result of that. Okay, and that's a very important mechanism in our body. Because what kind of condition would you have if a cell were to divide, okay, and never die, and then divide again, never die, divide again, and divide again, go over and over dividing? What kind of process would that seem like? I mean, eventually we turn into these big giants, right? But that's really not the case. What happens typically? Then a tumor would form. Yeah, then a cancer, and if it's a metastatic kind of tumor, then that's cancer. So this is just one way that your body protects itself from cancerous tumors or other kinds of tumors in the body. Okay, so that's a nice normal mechanism for maintaining senescence of a cell or a cell line, just making sure that a certain cell actually dies after its useful purpose has been used. Okay, and the enzyme that breaks these terminal ends off, we call that telomerase. And I think I mentioned this before. How do we know this is an enzyme? Because it has an ASE at the end of it. All right, so that's it for mitosis. I didn't go over all the details, so you got to read your textbook about it, and maybe you know a whole lot more from your anatomy class anyway. Any questions? Any questions on mitosis? Okay, I guess I have one more question. How did this zygote come into being? These are what we call somatic cells in your body. How did this first cell come to be? Because at one point in time, we all had a mom and a dad, right? And from dad, we got these things. What is that? It looks like a mouse, but I'm sorry. It shouldn't be a mouse, okay? This is a male gamete, right? Because you got it from your dad, a male gamete. And how many chromosomes does a male gamete have? It's got 23, right? So it's got 23 chromosomes. All right, and then here is a female gamete with 23 chromosomes. Can you name this thing here, the female gamete? It's a female sex cell. This is an egg or an oocyte. All right, I'll just write down oocyte. And then these two things come together to make this zygote. And you all know the name of that process, right? Okay. What is that process called? That is fertilization. Exactly right. That's fertilization. All right. So here you have a somatic cell with 46 chromosomes. How do you end up with these gametes? Can you name the process? This is just to give you a nice overview. That is meiosis. Yeah, so here we would have something called a germ cell. Okay, and it's going to divide into gametes via a process called meiosis. It's another way that the cell divides, but this is a way of reducing the genetic material in half as well. So maybe we can talk about that when we get to the reproductive chapter. Oh, that's what we have right here. Are these slides in your book, in your slide package? No, okay. Okay, maybe I'll cover that at another time. All right, so we're going to move into the next chapter, which is 4. That's not on the exam, right? Yeah, enzymes and energy. Well, we know a lot about this already, at least some nomenclature. So we're going to look at some enzymes, metabolic pathways, and then bioenergetics, some other kind of chemistry. Okay, so an enzyme. Let's define what an enzyme is. We call them biological catalysts. That's kind of a loaded term, so I want to describe some of these connotations of these two words. All right, but enzyme is a biological catalyst that increases the rate of a chemical reaction. All right, but we haven't in this class determined what a chemical reaction is. So let's write down what a chemical reaction is. Just a standard kind of chemical reaction. A chemical reaction is when we have a molecule, let's call it A, molecule A, and it can be converted into something else, or maybe it can add to another molecule. So let's say A plus B is going to become a new molecule, and let's just say it is C plus D, two different molecules. Or maybe A and B can be added together, and then you have A and B over there. But anyway, since we have the arrow going to the right on this illustration, these compounds over here are what we call reactants. And over here, these are called products. All right, so I'm going to use these terms. I'm not sure everybody has thought of chemistry in this kind of way just yet. Maybe in lab you talked about it. Okay, so this is a chemical reaction that can take place. And sometimes it happens very fast. Other times it can happen very slowly. And sometimes it can't happen at all because of the thermodynamics. We'll look at it. It's because C and D can only be converted into A and B, but it's almost impossible to go the other way around. Okay. All right, so here is just a nice chemical reaction, reactants and products, and it has a certain rate. The rate is just the appearance of products or the rate of a chemical reaction, not only the rate of the appearance of a product, but it could also be a measure of what? The disappearance of the reactants. Either way, they should be identical ways of thinking about a chemical reaction. Okay, and what do we have right here? You all probably have a bottle of hydrogen peroxide in your house, which can be used to clean lacerations and wounds up. Okay, hydrogen peroxide is this kind of compound, H2O2. Okay, and when you pour it on your body, it turns into oxygen plus water. What's water? H2O. Okay, I didn't balance this equation, but you could balance it out if you wanted. Just make sure the number of oxygens is the same on both sides. But that thing will happen. So when you pour hydrogen peroxide on your finger, this reaction happens very quickly. And it's really helpful because a lot of bacteria are poisoned by oxygen, and then that water irrigates the wound, just washes out bacteria from the wound. So it's really helpful to do that to some lacerations. All right, and that happens, right, very fast because there's an enzyme that allows this process to take place. All right, so this process does happen. As a matter of fact, if you take this hydrogen peroxide, or is it, if you look at the bottle, what does the bottle look like that hydrogen peroxide is in? It's brown, it's opaque, right? So light can't get into it because hydrogen peroxide likes to break down all by itself into oxygen and water. So it's a reaction that takes place, all right? But it takes place very slowly because you could have a hydrogen peroxide bottle in your medicine cabinet for years before it completely breaks down But if you have one in your cabinet for, say, 20 or 30 or 40 years, then guess what you have in that bottle? Probably oxygen and water, okay? All right, so this reaction does happen by itself, but in the bottle it happens very slowly. On your body it happens very fast because we have an enzyme here. So an enzyme increases the rate of that chemical reaction. And what is that? The rate of the chemical reaction is the appearance of water and oxygen or the disappearance of hydrogen peroxide. Okay. And these two chemical compounds really don't like to go back in the opposite direction. And an enzyme can't make that happen. An enzyme can only speed up the rate of a reaction that will automatically happen by itself, even though it might take a year, 2 years, or even 1,000 years, right? An enzyme can only increase the rate of a chemical reaction. All right, so a catalyst. Let's talk about a catalyst. It is visible. Okay, a catalyst is a compound that speeds up a rate of a chemical reaction, and it doesn't have to be an enzyme. It could just be a metal or some kind of surface where this reaction takes place on. But the important thing about a catalyst is that it doesn't get used up in the reaction. It never becomes part of the product over here. So if it speeds up the rate of the reaction takes place. So you have catalyst over here. I'll just say cat. And then over here, what do you have? The exact same catalyst and in the same amount. Right? It doesn't get used up. And so an enzyme, we say, is a biological catalyst because it's made up of one of those four biological compounds that we looked at in the previous chapter. Most are proteins. Some are nucleic acids, but not very many of them. And here is another concept. Enzymes work by lowering the activation energy required for a reaction to take place. All right, so how can we increase the rate, or how can we increase the activation energy of something? Let's pretend that these tabletops are made out of wood. Sort of looks like wood, okay? And what does that wood really want to do? It looks pretty stable. Looks like it wants to stay wood. But guess what wood wants to become? It wants to become CO2 and water. How long does that process take all by itself? Oh, yeah, millions of years. I don't know how stable wood is for a long time. Wood is just a glucose molecule put together in a certain kind of way, and it can break down into CO2 and water. But what is a way that we can speed up that conversion process of all this wood that we have in the room? Yeah, we can increase the temperature, right? We can give more energy to these molecules, and that will speed up the rate of that chemical reaction, right? So there are enzymes that can do that as well, but they can do it at a lower temperature. It doesn't have to be at a burning temperature. So let's take a look at this slide here. We've got a number of graphs. Here we have a plot of number of reactant molecules. So we're looking over here. These are reactants with plotted versus energy. And all of these molecules that are in this bottle or solution or whatever don't have exactly the same energy. They don't exactly have the same temperature. There's a distribution. There are some that have very little energy. Maybe they have a low temperature. And then there's some on the other end of the spectrum right here that have high energy. They're moving around a lot. Okay, so we can see, though, but if we look at the surface area, right, there are just very few compared to everything that we find in that sample. These are the molecules that can undergo the chemical reaction because they have sufficient energy, okay, to form products. All right, so this is what we call the activation energy. Let's look at the plot over here. Here we have, now instead of number of reactant molecules, but the energy, all right, versus the course of this chemical reaction. So if we have reactants over here, what are they going to make? They're going to make products, right? So here are reactants, and down over here we have products. So we could say A goes to A plus B, because I see two products down over here. And this chemical reaction will take place automatically because the reactants have more energy compared to the products, right? Because here is a graph of energy. Low energy is here. High energy is up over here. Reactants have more than products. But if there is a barrier for this to happen, like in this wood that we're sitting in front of, right, then that reaction is really slow. It's going to take a really long time. So how can we speed that reaction up? We can heat up the sample, and that will increase the number of molecules that have the activation energy, and they can hop over this barrier, like when you put a match to a newspaper or a piece of wood or something. And then these products are going to be CO2 and water. All right, so that's not with an enzyme. So let's put an enzyme in this condition right here. Let's put an enzyme in there. So if we put an enzyme and keep the sample at exactly the same temperature, right, so here we have number of reactant molecules. It's going to be the same temperature. Now look at the number of molecules that have the proper or enough activation energy to undergo the reaction. Is it more or less or the same? Okay, because you can see that the number of molecules that can undergo the reaction in this looks like orange to me. What is that?
Green.
Ah, really close. Okay, this green area right here, almost the same color. All right, so over here, before the enzyme is added, very few molecules. After the enzyme is added, no change in energy of the reactants, but more molecules have sufficient energy to undergo the chemical reaction. So let's look at this illustration down below it. So when we add an enzyme, it reduces the height of this barrier. See, we have a tall barrier over here without the enzyme. We have a really short barrier over here with the enzyme. And so more reactants can actually hop over this barrier, and when they do, they can form products, because that's just normally what likes to happen. All right, so let's compare these two energy versus time diagrams here at the bottom. What can you tell me about the activation energy between non-enzyme versus enzyme? And it's with this nice purple arrow right here. Okay, without the enzyme, it's a big arrow. With the enzyme, it's what? It's a smaller arrow because the activation energy is reduced. Okay, now let's look at the conversion or the release of energy when this reaction takes place. All right, and what is that energy that's released? It's from the energy that the reactants have compared to what the energy of the products has. And we see that with this nice, you told me this is green? Look like it's the same color here. This green arrow right here, all right, compared to the green arrow when we add the enzyme. What can you tell me about the release of energy with the enzyme compared to without the enzyme? It's exactly the same. All right, so when you add an enzyme, you can't get more energy out of the system. You can just make the conversion happen more quickly. You can make it happen faster. Another way of saying it is that an enzyme can't make the reverse of the reaction take place, right, but it just can make the formation of products a lot faster by reducing the activation energy. All right, so I think that's an important term, important concept for you to see, that this green arrow, they're exactly the same, with or without the enzyme. It's just the rate of conversion is faster with the enzyme because it reduces the activation energy. Okay, so the ability of enzymes to lower energy requirement is due to structure. Enzymes have because they're proteins, they have a three-dimensional shape. We call that a conformation. And they have certain areas on the surface of an enzyme, which we call an active site. And the reactants fit into that active site. So how would you explain why a reactant can fit into an active site on an enzyme? It's by shape and size, right? So the active site has to be complementary to the shape of a reactant molecule, and then it will like to fit onto the surface of the enzyme. Okay. Sometimes in an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, if we have an enzyme right here, we just call this a substrate. And on the other side of the chemical reaction, we call these substrates as well. So both reactants and products in an enzyme-catalyzed reaction are considered substrates. All right, and enzymes work by bringing these substrates close together so that they can react. So I have another way of thinking about this. Okay, I have these two markers right here. What can you tell me about this one? Black, here is blue. Okay, so these are going to be the reactants, black and blue. And they can come together to form a product. What's this right here? Black-blue. Maybe it's blue-black to you, but black to me it's black-blue. So let's use black-blue so I don't get confused. Okay. So this is a product, just like this. How are the other ways that these two markers can bump into each other that won't allow the chemical reaction to take place? What happens if it goes like that, even though it's still black-blue? Will that make a product? No, because I could let go of the blue marker and it would fall on the floor. What about if I put it over here? Now we have what? Blue-black. That's not exactly the same thing as black-blue. As a matter of fact, that might be a harmful compound that builds up inside the cell. It's not the product that the cell wants. All right, what happens if they bump into each other like that? Will the reaction take place? No. What about like this? No. What about like that? How many different ways can I put these two markers together so that the reaction doesn't take place? Probably millions of different ways, like here, 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 here. All right, but what is the one way that these molecules have to bump into each other in order for the reaction to proceed? There's only one way, right? And that's like this, so that you get black-blue. So what an enzyme does, it allows these substrates to come close enough to each other in just the right way so that they can form a product. And that's what we call decreasing the activation energy for a chemical reaction. All right, so here is an exam figure, I'm sure. And we have two substrates, A and B, over here. So these are what we call reactants. Then we have two products, but these are substrates as well, C and D. All right, so A and B is going to be converted into C plus D, and that's just what we call, what, a chemical reaction, and it's going to be catalyzed by this enzyme so that it can be sped up inside of a cell. Here is an enzyme. Let's consider this a protein. Here's the normal conformation of this protein, and it just so happens that here's a little surface on the enzyme, or this protein, which is complementary to substrate A. So substrate A would like to fit into this site. Okay, and substrate B will fit into this active site over here. And when they fit in, they just happen to come together in the right way to allow the chemical reaction to take place. Okay, this thing right here is what we call the enzyme substrate complex. All right, so both substrates have to bind to the enzyme before the reaction can proceed. And then this enzyme substrate complex dissociates and you end up with product C and product D over here, which are what? Different than what we started with. Oh, maybe you could see. I see two different colors. First time I ever saw that. Wow. Two different colors right here, because here is what was on substrate A. Now it's on substrate D. Okay. Now what about the enzyme? We talked about this just briefly. I see the enzyme substrate complex over here. I see an enzyme here and an enzyme here. What's the difference in this enzyme at the beginning of the reaction compared to the end? What about the color? Color is the same. What about the shape? Shape is the same. And as a matter of fact, that's really true, right? The enzyme does not get destroyed, does not get changed when a chemical reaction takes place, which is the definition of a catalyst. So this enzyme can catalyze this reaction over and over and over again. And so substrates decrease and then products increase in concentration. So the other thing is that in order for products to form, the enzyme substrate complex has to form first, right? That's a necessary step. So that's why this is a nice exam figure. If for some reason you block the building up of this enzyme substrate complex, guess what you're doing to the rate of that chemical reaction? You're slowing it down or even stopping it. Okay, so the shape of the enzyme has to be maintained. Yeah, reaction occurs. Enzyme is unaltered. That's a really important concept. Okay, and sometimes, so let's talk about enzymes. Most enzymes, if they're described in modern times, they have an ASE after them. Right, that's a modern nomenclature. Some enzymes don't have an ASE on the end of them because maybe they were discovered 40, 50, 60 years ago, okay? And that was before the nomenclature was established. All right, so most have an ASE. Some enzymes are named according to the activity or the chemical reaction that they catalyze. And that's really kind of handy. Maybe you could think of muscles. All right, like what muscle am I doing to contracting to flex my fingers? The flexor digitorum, right? So that's really easy to know the names of some muscles because they're named after the action that they perform. Same thing for enzymes. Some enzymes are named after the chemical reaction that they speed up. So for instance, a phosphatase is something that removes a phosphate group from a molecule. And maybe you should have in your mind what the picture of a phosphate group looks like, but it's a PO4 molecule, highly polar. All right, so a phosphatase will hydrolyze that inorganic phosphate group from some molecule. A kinase, on the other hand, will add a phosphate group to something. All right, and so what can you tell me about the activity? What's the relationship between a phosphatase and a kinase? I think it's like, what? Biceps brachii and triceps brachii. They're antagonistic to each other. One performs one function and the other performs the reverse function. So you might think that's pretty futile, but in terms of your body, is it really handy to have a biceps and a triceps? What do you have if you have both working as opposed to one? Precise control and balance over your hand or your fingertip, right? So that's really important, especially maybe tomorrow night. Why is that? Because it's Friday and you're going to be drinking and you might be pulled over by that woman in the nice blue uniform badge and sidearm, and they're going to tell you, put your fingertip on your nose, just like that, they'll do a sobriety test, right? And the easiest way to do that is when you have a nice antagonistic motor system to do that. I wouldn't go into that kind of detail if you get pulled over, though. Just perform what they ask you to do. All right, so here are two enzymes that work on that same principle of antagonism. It's not a futile system. This provides for precise control and balance of whatever these enzymes are working on. The addition or removal of a phosphate group is a way to activate a molecule or deactivate it, and by the correct balance of these two enzymes, then you have the correct activity inside of a cell. All right, so enzymes may be named after the substrate that the enzyme catalyzes. For instance, like lactate dehydrogenase, we know it's an enzyme because of the ASE over here. And so that's an enzyme. What is the substrate that it works on? It works on lactate or lactic acid. Okay, so it's going to do something to lactate. And when I say lactate or lactic acid, that's exactly the same chemical compound. So if I say pyruvate or pyruvic acid, that's exactly the same thing. Okay, I'll use those terms interchangeably. I don't know why I would say one over the other, but I do sometimes. Here are some very important biological catalysts. What are we going to call a biological catalyst? An enzyme. These are all proteins. And catalase is an enzyme that will break down hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen very rapidly. So that's why you see bubbles when you pour hydrogen peroxide on a wound, because hydrogen peroxide is toxic to our cells. And it can build up, and it has to be degraded right away. So we have catalase or other forms of this enzyme called peroxidase. And as a matter of fact, you probably know a vesicle that contains a lot of this enzyme. What would that be? That would be a peroxisome. And what did we say, what's the function of a peroxisome? Detoxification. Detoxifies, or actually breaks down this level of hydrogen peroxide and other kinds of compounds that the cell builds up so that they're not toxic. Carbonic anhydrase is going to be hugely important in our class. It can combine carbon dioxide with water and make carbonic acid. And then, so it will catalyze this reaction very rapidly. And this reaction could go actually in either direction. It can go backwards and forwards. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. Amylase is an enzyme that can break starch down into maltose. So what kind of reaction is this right here? What kind of reaction? Is this a dehydration synthesis? No, it is what? A hydrolysis reaction, sure. Okay, here is lactate dehydrogenase. Ribonuclease is a hydrolysis, which is the breakdown of an RNA molecule. It can break down RNA into what? Into ribonucleotides, the basic building block of RNA. What's the basic building block of DNA? This could help you on a test. Deoxyribonucleotide. Okay, so work with the, before the test, look at the video maybe a couple times. All right, so enzyme activity is the rate at which substrates are converted into products. All right, so it's the disappearance, the rate of disappearance of substrates, or the rate of appearance of products, one and the same thing. So we could plot this out. We could look at enzyme activity versus temperature, and what is this enzyme activity right here? This is the appearance of products, right? So we could measure how products are being built up inside of a chemical mixture. And if we change the temperature and measure the rate at which products are forming, then we can then plot out enzyme activity versus temperature. And for this particular enzyme, because we're thinking about an enzyme right here, what happens to this enzyme system as we increase the temperature? Does the rate stay the same? No, it doesn't. It's changing. Which way is it changing? It's going up, right? So the enzyme is catalyzing the reaction faster and faster and faster and faster. So products are forming more fast, right, as we increase the temperature up to a certain point. And then what happens? Then I see a big crash in activity once we get, okay, up above body temperature, and for sure at 100 degrees, that's when water starts to boil, because this is centigrade right here. All right, so what is happening right in this area where the rate is decreasing? What's happening? Yeah, the enzyme is changing. And as a matter of fact, the enzyme is changing so much that the enzyme-substrate complex cannot form. Okay? And that's because the shape of the enzyme is changing. It's twisting and turning all the time. The shape of the active site has been distorted. So now substrates can't bind to the enzyme. And if substrates can't bind, then no products can form. And if the temperature rises so high, okay, then the enzyme, as a matter of fact, can change shape so drastically that there can be no chemical reaction. Something else can happen too. Right? If we change the temperature in this region for that enzyme, if we heat the enzyme up, the rate of the reaction increases. If we cool the enzyme down, the rate of the reaction decreases. Right? It can go backwards and forwards. In this region right here, right, once we've killed the activity of the enzyme completely, usually that's because we've modified the shape of the enzyme so much, right, that it can't go back to its original conformation, can't go back to its original shape. So even if we cool this enzyme back down, if we cool it back down, it's still going to have zero activity. We call that denaturation. So denaturation not only makes the activity of that enzyme go to zero, but it also makes it an irreversible process. Right? And that happens with biological catalysts all the time. Okay, so not only does activity change with temperature, it also changes with pH, because different groups will ionize, it will change hydrogen bonding within the molecule, change the shape of that protein. And here I see a plot of enzyme activity for three different enzymes, pepsin, trypsin, and salivary amylase. Oh, what did we say amylase does? Breaks down starch into more simple sugars, like maltose, for instance, versus pH. All right, so if we go down in this direction, what's happening to the pH? The number is getting smaller, which means what? It's becoming more acidic, right? And if we go over this way, pH increases, which means it's becoming more basic. So over here, we have a lot more hydrogen ions. Here we have an enzyme inside our body that has an optimal pH at 2. That's really strange. That's very, very acidic, right? But this enzyme can only work at this pH to degrade that peptide bond. Peptide bonds are very stable, and you need to have drastic conditions and a really sophisticated enzyme to break that peptide bond, right? And that's what we have a stomach for. Pepsin is secreted by the stomach in an inactive form. It becomes activated, and it can start to break down proteins into smaller molecules for a more complete digestion. Right, and pepsin only works at this low pH. This material then moves into the small intestine. Right, small intestine comes after the stomach. And the pH of the large intestine now becomes very basic because the pancreas and other glands secrete bases into the lumen of the small intestine, bicarbonate, for instance. And that raises the pH, and then there's another enzyme that can then complete the digestion of proteins. But again, that can only happen under a really drastic condition of very high pH. And the enzyme that does that in the small intestine is trypsin. Would trypsin have any activity in the stomach at all? Nope, because if we follow the activity, the pH of the stomach is way too low in order for that to happen. As a matter of fact, if you take trypsin and you reduce the pH of the solution that it's in, not only are you reducing its activity, but you also might change the conformation so drastically that it becomes irreversibly damaged. Okay, and you can see salivary amylase is in saliva, and saliva is about a pH of 7, okay, or neutral. And that works in our mouth for a short period of time. All right, so here is a way that we can preserve foods by increasing the temperature of those foods, right? I can take a hamburger, raw hamburger. If I were French, I would really love it just like that, okay? But I don't particularly like hamburger like that. What would most people do? Yeah, they would denature it by throwing it on the barbecue, increase the temperature, denature those proteins. And indeed, does a hamburger look different to you before and after it's cooked? Sure, because those proteins are denatured. You can also cook proteins by using pH. That's another way of preserving foods. So who has used maybe an acid to cook food, even at a low temperature? Like lemon juice on fish, making ceviche, or sauerbraten is a way to cook beef with acetic acid or vinegar. There's probably many pickles. That's another, I don't know if they're necessarily, yeah, they changed structure a little bit, but for sure they're preserved. And also salt concentration can change the formation, can change the conformation of a protein. And again, that's another way of preserving or cooking foods at a low temperature. All right, so what did I want to say about that? Oh, yeah. Okay, and so to illustrate this point of irreversibility, so I've cooked at my hamburger tonight. I'm ready to eat a really nice hamburger. It's cooked just the way I would like it. And I get a telephone call from my friends down at the pool hall, and they say, hey, we got 3 players, and guess what? We need a 4th player. Are you going to come down to pool with us? And so what am I going to say? Well, of course I will, right? So I take my hamburger. And you might think that I would eat it on the way there, but I don't want to eat on the way there. I take my hamburger and do what? Put it in the refrigerator. And what happens to that hamburger? Does it go back to looking like, cursor, does it go back to looking like a raw hamburger? No, it doesn't, because those proteins have been denatured, right? And that's an irreversible change. All right, so here are a list of enzymes with some pHs where they perform at their optimal activity. And I don't think I really want you to know any of these, but you can just see that various enzymes work at different pHs depending on where their activity is in the body. But what is important about this slide right here is I could ask you, is monoamine oxidase, is that an enzyme? How would you know? Because there's an ASC. Okay, what about lipase? Yeah, that's an enzyme because there's an ASC right here. All right, lipase is named with a modern nomenclature because it has an ASC on the end, but it also incorporated into the name is the name of the substrate. So what's the substrate that lipase can act on? Yeah, acts on lipids. And you now know some ways that lipids are put together, some chemical formulas for lipids, and probably one important lipid would be a triglyceride. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? 3 fatty acids and a glycerol molecule. Yeah, glycerol. Okay. So make sure for the test you know how to calculate the molecular weight of glucose, for instance, if I give you the chemical formula, or glycerol, for instance. Right? That should be pretty easy to do at this point in time. Okay, an enzyme sometimes needs to have a cofactor associated with it. Sometimes they're necessary for normal activity of enzymes. And here's a cofactor. Here's a list of some cofactors in our body. Calcium, magnesium, manganese, copper, zinc, selenium. All right, and what could you tell me about magnesium right here? Could you recognize that was magnesium? I should have asked you. Yeah, because that's a chemical symbol. What's this one here? Manganese. And, oh, these all kind of look the same. They have a little bit different size and shape because they're different sizes. But they have the same electrical properties. Okay, and so how would we? What are these things really? These are ions, right? That's one way to think of them. And how would you characterize a calcium ion? It's a divalent cation. What about magnesium? Divalent cation because it has 2 positive charges. Right. Same thing for copper and zinc over here as well. So these things can bind to enzymes because it's going to bind to a site on the enzyme that has a negative charge. Remember, opposite charges attract each other. And when it binds, it's going to change the conformation of that enzyme. That's like your friend poking you in the side. Okay? When calcium binds to an enzyme, it changes conformation a little bit. And it can change the conformation of the enzyme such that it allows the building up of the proper active site. So the active site won't have the proper shape unless the enzyme is bound to one of these different metal ions that we call a cofactor. So some enzymes require cofactors in order for the active site to take its normal conformation. Remember, you got to have that active site before what can form. The active site has to have the right shape before what can form. The enzyme substrate complex, right? So without these cofactors, the enzyme substrate complex can't form, which means what? No product formation. All right, so a cofactor, at least for this class, I want you to know are these small metal ions. So these are small molecules, right? They do have an electrical charge on them, but these are really small inorganic or metal ions. That's our definition of a cofactor, if it can change the activity of an enzyme. Then there's something else called a coenzyme. Coenzymes are derived from vitamins, and these molecules, as opposed to cofactors, are huge organic molecules. And they might contain calcium or magnesium or some other kinds of things, but they're going to contain a lot of oxygens and carbons and nitrogens, right, to make an organic molecule, and these things are going to be huge. So cofactors are small, inorganic. Coenzymes are large organic molecules, so there's a big difference between them. And the job of a coenzyme, all right, is not to catalyze a reaction, but to transport molecules around inside the cell from one chemical reaction to another, or from one enzyme to another. And without that transport, the chemical reaction cannot take place. So they do regulate the rate of the chemical reaction, but they're transporters. They carry something. As a matter of fact, you have, what can you tell me about ATP? Is it a large organic molecule or a small metal ion? It's a large organic molecule. And what is it carrying around inside the cell? This is pretty abstract, but I think it's a good thing to think of. It is carrying energy from one chemical reaction to another chemical reaction. So you could actually think of ATP as a coenzyme because it's carrying energy from one chemical reaction to another, and it's not a cofactor. It's a large organic molecule. So energy, you should understand to be a real physical entity, right? Just like calcium or some other compounds in our body, right? But it's hard to visualize energy because it's a construct in our mind. But it's measurable, it's very real. All right, so let's look at cofactors and coenzymes. Here is a cofactor, and I see it here and here and here. It's just a small metal ion, right? A cofactor is a small metal ion, and it can bind to enzymes in different ways. A cofactor can bind to an enzyme at a site other than these active sites. So here are two active sites for substrates, green and blue. And the active site doesn't allow proper binding of these substrates unless the cofactor binds over here. And when it binds over here, it changes the conformation. So now the substrates can bind to the active site. And when it does, oh, what is this thing right here? What's that called? Yeah, that's a complex. That's the enzyme substrate complex, right? And it can form because this cofactor is binding to some location other than the active site. But a cofactor could also bind within the active site. So if a cofactor binds right here, again, it's going to change the shape of this enzyme, or at least the active site of that enzyme, so that these substrates can bind, an enzyme substrate complex forms, which means what? If an enzyme substrate complex can form, what happens? Then products form as a result, which means that the chemical reaction can be catalyzed. All right, so this arrow right here does not mean a jump from here to here, right? This little arrow is just pointing to the cofactor where it's attached to the enzyme, right, within the active site or outside of the active site. Okay, so that's how cofactors work. And they're not used up in the chemical reaction, just like an enzyme is, right? So you can't convert, for instance, copper into gold. Would that be nice if we had an enzyme to do that? But it can't, right? If copper binds to this enzyme, when it's released, it is what? It's copper, right? The same element. Okay. Control of enzyme activity. and enzyme activation, or you could say, think of this as being deactivation the same way. So many enzymes are produced in an inactive form. Could anybody think of a good reason why we would want to produce an enzyme in an inactive form? And maybe even give me the name of an enzyme. And a good name would be pepsin, for instance. What does pepsin do? It breaks down proteins, right? And it's in your stomach. What is your stomach made out of? It's made out of protein. So pepsin can auto-digest the stomach, and it can even auto-digest the organ that produces it, that makes it. So what happens is, all right, in order to protect these organs from auto-digestion, the enzyme is produced in an inactive form, and then it's transported to where it should have its activity, and it then is converted into an active form by maybe phosphorylation or dephosphorylation or cleavage of some part of the molecule. And then those organs have some kind of, some form of protection so that they don't be digested themselves. Some other examples would be pancreatic enzymes, like for instance trypsin, chymotrypsin, produced by the pancreas, right, are produced in an inactive form. They're transported to the small intestine, and when they reach the small intestine, they're converted into the active form. And that should probably tell you why diseases of the pancreas are so dangerous, right? Because when the pancreas is diseased, these inactive enzymes can be activated within the pancreas, and then what happens to the pancreas? It just gets digested right inside of us, right? Pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer, really tough diseases to treat because the pancreas is so susceptible to autodigestion. Okay, so many are activated by phosphorylation, inactivated by dephosphorylation. So what kind of enzyme would you use to activate an enzyme in this particular case? Okay, activated by phosphorylation, what enzyme would you use? I know you didn't have time to study this, but it's really good that we go over this. The name of that enzyme would be a kinase, Adds a phosphate to a molecule, activating it. What would you use to dephosphorylate something? Dephosphorylate means you take the phosphate group off. What kind of reaction would be used for that? Hydrolysis reaction. Okay, and the name of an enzyme would be a phosphatase, right? So with the balance between the kinase and phosphatase, then this enzyme activity can be precisely controlled and balanced, okay, by this nice antagonistic system right here. Others are activated by other small molecules called ligands, and some of these ligands can be second messengers inside the cell. And we'll look at some examples of that later on. Okay, here is something that you're kind of familiar with already when we looked at membrane transport. Remember, transporters require an active site. The molecule that's being transported has to bind to the transporter before it can move across the membrane. All right, so that binding of the transporter is very similar to the binding of a substrate to an enzyme, which then will allow the reaction to take place. So if we measure the rate of a chemical reaction, keep the pH the same, keep the temperature the same, right? Keep all the physical concentrations, physical attributes of that system the same, and only vary the concentration of the substrate up or down and measure the rate of the chemical reaction, we see that as we increase the substrate concentration, what happens to the reaction rate or the buildup of products? It increases, and it increases. When we increase substrate, it increases, but notice it starts to slow down. And eventually, it levels off. It doesn't get any higher. The rate doesn't get any faster, even though we increase the rate or increase the concentration of substrates in solution. That's what we call saturation. So what's happening when an enzyme is saturated? All the active sites are bound with substrates already, so that if we add additional substrates to that solution, there's no active site for it to bind to anyway. So the rate of the chemical reaction remains the same, right? So, and that's the maximal rate. So we have specificity for enzymes, just like we did for transporters, saturation, okay? And that specificity just means that an enzyme will bind a substrate only if that substrate has what? The correct shape. It's got to have the correct shape to fit in there, all right? And if it's some other kind of molecule without the right shape, then it won't bind to the active site. Some reactions are reversible, like the one I drew on the board over here, which I didn't draw this one on the board. Maybe a couple times ago I drew this one on the board. We have water and carbon dioxide. And do we have a lot of water in our body? Plenty. What about carbon dioxide? Plenty. Our bodies are producing carbon dioxide. That's the reason why we exhale. All right, so we have plenty of carbon dioxide in our body. We also have the enzyme that catalyzes this reaction, and it produces carbonic acid. Okay, and what does anybody know the name of that enzyme that speeds up the rate of this reaction? Carbonic anhydrase. All right, it's even on the slide right here. Carbonic anhydrase. Okay, catalyzes this reaction. Now, when I look at this arrow, how many points does this arrow have? Two. So this is a bidirectional arrow. And these compounds right here can go in the forward direction or from left to right or in the reverse direction, right to left. And it happens very fast if there is this enzyme, carbonic anhydrase, in solution. It won't happen very fast if there is no carbonic anhydrase, but eventually it will go one way or the other. So how do you know which way this is going to go? It's going to be determined by the concentration of each of these substrates right here. So if the substrate of CO2, if this concentration of CO2 increases, it's going to force the reaction to the right. The concentration of CO2 is going to go down, and carbonic acid will increase. If we take carbon dioxide out of the system, it's going to force the reaction to the left. Some of this carbonic acid is going to break down to rebuild that concentration of CO2. All right, so the reaction is forced in the opposite direction if we add substrates, and it will be forced, right, in the reverse direction if we remove substrates. All right, so what will happen to water and carbon dioxide if we take away carbonic acid? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen to the concentration of water and CO2? They're going to decrease because carbonic anhydrase is going to take these substrates and make carbonic acid out of them. Okay? And so this is what we call the law of mass action. If certain thermodynamics is obeyed in this system right here, then this reaction can go backwards and forwards, and is just determined by the concentration of the substrates on either side of this reaction. Some of you might know this by another name. Does anybody know this by another name? Probably you talk about it with this name in chemistry. I don't think chemists really say law of mass action, but they would say Le Chatelier's principle. Have you heard of that? No. Okay. Well, law of mass action then is much more simple to spell. All right, and it just says that these reactants can go backwards and forwards as long as what takes place? As long as the free energy of the products is very similar or equal to the free energy of the products. If the free energy is the same, or if the energy is the same, then no energy is needed or released when this chemical reaction takes place. And these products can zip back and forth only depending on their concentration. So if we go way back to that, close your eyes, if I can find, oh, right here. Okay, so here we have water and carbon dioxide. Where would carbonic acid be on this diagram? Would it be roll down this hill? Absolutely not. It would have the same energy level, okay? Meaning it could go backwards and forwards. It doesn't take energy to run back up this hill, okay? And what does carbonic anhydrase do to this activation barrier? It reduces it, okay? So that reaction forwards and backwards can happen very fast. So the balance of CO2 and carbonic acid in your body is maintained very rapidly and in the proper ways to maintain homeostasis. Okay, so law of mass action, that's going to be good. Metabolic pathways. When do we get to talk about metabolic pathways? On Thursday. Okay, 1 week from today, because on Tuesday is your first exam. Make sure you use those study guides to get ready for that exam. Law of mass action is spontaneous. Okay, it will happen no matter what. With an enzyme, it will just happen real fast. Some systems, It will happen, but really slowly. Might take hundreds of years. It depends on the activation energy barrier. Yeah.
I will be around.